My name is Greg Getterman, and I'm an alcoholic. Not only that, I'm a grateful alcoholic. But what does that mean? Who am I? Right now in the U.S., there are 21.5 million people just like me. One in 10. That's alcoholics and addicts. That doesn't count other addictions, porn, food, gambling, shopping. The numbers skyrocket from there. Somebody like me has a 10% chance of ever seeking treatment. 90% of us never do. Of those people that seek treatment, 1 in 10 will get sober. The rest of us die from this disease. Be liver failure, heart attack, an accident, an overdose, car crash. We don't survive this. The odds are very, very slim. And as I tell my story, you realize how blessed I am to be standing here today. It's a gift that I can see my family again today. A little bit more about who we are. Right now, as we sit today in Allen County, there have been over 800 overdoses in Allen County this year. All of last year, there were 400. I believe there are, 236,000 people in Allen County? Do the math. It's a lot of people. We currently have 280 beds in Allen County to treat 5,000 people seeking treatment. That's it. Our odds are not good. But by the grace of God, I am here and I am recovered today. So I say I'm a grateful alcoholic. Why do I say that? You know, I've had the chance to be here and share in small groups. And somebody last week was like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say you're an alcoholic. No, I am. Call me who I am. And I'm grateful. Why? Because I've got to be in the worst place that humanity can devise, in my own personal earthly hell, hopeless, alone, with no chance. Yet I was saved. And I stand before you today with a mission, with a purpose, with a God-given mandate for what I have to do. I have a purpose every day I wake up. And I am no longer alone and hopeless and suicidal. Today, I get the glory in every day, even though they're hard, because He's given me a chance to help. I'll tell you a little bit about my story. My parents divorced when I was 3. My mom was an opiate addict. And with all of that came the moves. By the time I graduated high school, I had been to 17 different schools. So it was not uncommon for us to come home and everything that we, what little we had, would be packed in the car and off we went again. What that did for me is I never made friends. I never had a close relationship with anyone. You know, my mom would be locked in her room, passed out on whatever drug it was at that point, and it was just my brother and I. And I never built lasting friendships because I knew they were going to be torn away from me. So from my earliest age, all I remember is wanting to die. And we're talking 8, 9 years old. I would fantasize about hanging myself. And this was my whole life. I was hopeless. I would always be that person. So I was also raised kind of ultra-Catholic. On my mom's side, they were nuns and priests and things like this. And we went to Catholic school and we did all the cool things. And in 8th grade, my mom had a breakdown and went to a mental institution. So I went to live with my dad. And that was the first time I'd ever really gone to live with my dad that I remember. Well, he was fundamentalist Baptist. Those two religions didn't get along very well. And I remember one of my first trips home, I told my aunt, who had been a nun for 40 years, that she was going to hell because she was an idolater. That did not go over well. And I was confused. You know, how can this sect of Christianity and this sect of Christianity be so diametrically opposed? So I turned my back on all of it. I had no use for it. What I did find when I turned 16 was alcohol. I went to high school and I was 4'8" and weighed about 83 pounds. I was tiny. And I was a nerd and I was in Latin club and honor society and nobody liked me except the other nerds. And I always wanted to be cool. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be like the jocks and they had the cool cars and the cheerleaders. And that wasn't me. But then I started drinking. And my very first drunk was right after I turned 16 and borrowed my dad's car. It was a blackout. But I had arrived. I was popular. I was really cool. They liked me. I fit in. And that was the pattern of my life for the next 20 years. I was still suicidal. I still hated myself. I was still a horrible person. I destroyed my family. I destroyed my friends. Most of all, my children. I couldn't be a parent. I was drunk. And everything for me revolved around alcohol. I had this hole inside of me that I couldn't fill. No matter how much money I had, no matter which business I ran, no matter how big my house was, no matter how many women I had, it just got worse and worse. The more I had, the more I wanted. The more I wanted, the less I had. The worse I felt. And eventually, I couldn't do it anymore. At all. And I had seen my mom, as I mentioned, she was an opiate addict, so she had destroyed herself over all these years, but I didn't know anything about addiction or alcohol. We didn't know what was wrong with her. We thought she was borderline personality disorder, schizophrenic, you name it. We had her treated for it. Electroshock therapy, yes, they still do that. But I didn't know that her problem was opiates, and I didn't know my problem was alcohol. And so on June 21st, 2010, I couldn't do anymore. I thought I would end up like her, that the rest of my life would be hopeless, in and out of shelters and begging for my family to take care of me, and as my kids slipped away and became just like me. So I decided that was it. I've been suicidal my whole life. This is the time. I'm going to do it. And I crawled into a car, poured gasoline in that car, closed the doors, and lit it on fire. Car burnt to the frame. My dad's seen pictures of it. There was nothing left of that car. Furthermore, there was nobody there to pull me out of that car. Yet, I walked out basically unscathed. The last thing I remember is a big orange flash, who knew, and somebody pulling me from that car. There was nobody within two blocks. Now, the report says that the pressure wave blew me out the back window. It was a PT Cruiser. The back window's about that tall. I'm not all that big, but I'm bigger than that. And cops show up, and I'm standing on the porch drinking beer. My clothes are smoldering. No eyebrows, of course. And they haul me off to jail and put me in a padded cell. And, of course, I do what so many of us do, right? You know, hey, Dad, come get me. Mom, come get me. My brother, come get me. Nope. You're where you belong. Saved my life, because they were right. That is where I belonged. You know, I'd been in and out of jail. I'd been arrested. I've done an abuse. I've been through every court-ordered program in northern Indiana, and I think at that point I was on probation in three different counties. That is where I belonged. And because they left me there, I'm here today. So I'm still suicidal. I'm really burnt up. I'm pretty depressed. And Rocky comes in to Bluffton jail every Thursday and has chapel, and all the guys use it to go and talk to each other, right, and pass notes, because you can't pass notes between the blocks and you can't really talk to your friends, and it's just chaos. And I didn't want to go, but my cellmate wanted some alone time, so I went that Thursday, and that was July 24th, 2010. And the minute I walked through that door, it was like somebody hit me right between the eyes with a sledgehammer. I couldn't do it anymore. I gave up. I surrendered. From that minute forward, I've never wanted another drink. Ever. And it was hard. It was difficult. It was challenging. You know, eventually my family came and got me out in September because my mom was dying and they wanted me to take care of her. And the first thing I did was went to an AA meeting in a church and checked myself into Park Center. One of the hardest things I did in that period of my life is I had to put my mom at a distance because she was still using. I couldn't be around her. I had learned that my sobriety was more important than anything else. And she passed away when I was 9 months sober from her opiate addiction. And I never really had the chance to make those amends to her. But I'm sober today, and it's a trade I'd make again. So I got the chance to go through Park Center and working my 12 steps and be involved in church and teach at the Methodist Ministry Academy about, yes, Oh, sorry, I thought you were asking a question. And teach addictions ministry and learn all these great things. And so I'm 15 months sober. And then, oh, the justice system comes calling, right? Because you can't blow up somebody's car and not go to jail. And I may have forgot to mention that. I was a little drunk, so it wasn't actually my car. It was the car next to my car. They were very upset. So here I am 15 months sober. I'm putting my life back together. I've got my sobriety. I'm sponsoring. I'm doing all these great things. And I go before the judge. And I walk in, and the prosecutor says, you're going to do about 30, 45 days community service. And I had all these people to testify, you know, character witnesses. The judge said, nope, you've had one chance too many. Full sentence. 3 years, 2 to 1. And away I go. Lost everything again. Second time in 15 months. So I did my year. And again, it was one of the best experiences I have ever had. By doing that time, by getting to be there, 73% of all people that are incarcerated right now are there for nonviolent drug and alcohol offenses. I got to see me. And I got to see what help they had there, which is none. And I got to start to reach out and form this idea of for what I do today. And so again, it's not an experience I would trade for anything. Most people would say going to prison is a horrible thing. No, it gave me this great chance to serve. To share the faith and the gift that I had been given for free that I didn't deserve. And so I got to come home a year later, and the hardest part of that was not seeing my kids. But I came home and I knew I had to make a difference. I had to change something. We can't keep going back to jail. We're not criminals, we're addicts, and we're alcoholics. It's not a choice, it's who we are. And so I founded, within a couple months of coming home, I started my construction companies. And I thought, well, I'll put these guys back to work. Right? And it'll be an all-sober construction crew. You know, Matt, you worked for me. The problem was, is I couldn't keep them sober. Right? They were going to all these other houses and these other places, and they would show up to work, and everybody's sober, and we'd talk about recovery, and then they'd leave at the end of the day, and they wouldn't come back. So last year in 2016, between February and September, I went through 28 guys that I lost to jails, relapse, and death. And I knew it had to change because it was only accelerating. So I was fortunate enough that a person I had gone to high school with is a real estate developer. And he said, Greg, what about this building? Could you do something with that? And that's Hobson House today. It was really cool. And I said, I sure can. So we bought it last August and spent 4 months designing it and changing the building around and putting it together. And we opened in January of this year. And our capacity is 15 men. Our first 3 months are free. It's a different program. They stay with me for a year, but I believe in mind, body, and spirit. It's faith, recovery, and action. And that is how we live today. We go to the gym 3 times a week. We're doing community service work 4 times a week now. We go to at least 4 types of therapy a week. We have 1 to 2 12-step meetings every single day. And then in addition to that, we have an open house, as Marvin mentioned. Everybody is welcome at our house as long as you want help, as long as you want to recover, as long as you want to become a new person. And every Saturday we have this great party that started out with like 5 of us and me, and it's called Fun in Recovery. And because most of us don't know how to have any fun. We know how to drink, we know how to shoot up, chase women at the bar, but we don't know how to have any fun sober. So it started with about 5 of us, and Saturday night, we had 83 people that were there, and it has opened everybody. So about 20 of those people were children under 10, running around, having fun, playing kickball with Matt and lighting off fireworks. And thanks to Marvin and Associated Churches that have stepped up and helped us continue to do this mission, because at the heart of what we have to be is we have to be a faith family. None of us recover alone. You guys over here that maybe never have shot heroin, and you guys over here that maybe have, we're all the same. We're all sinners. We all fall short. But we all have redemption and faith. And that's what changed my life. I have no doubt who pulled me out of that fire. I never doubted that. And I have no doubt what my mission is. And that loneliness and that suicidal thought and that hopelessness was one thing. And it's what we all share in addiction and alcoholism, is a hole inside of us, a blackness. And funny enough, it's a God-shaped hole. And he fits in there just perfectly. And if we allow him in, the sky's the limit. We can do anything. And today, I am blessed to be an alcoholic because all of those things, all of that life has prepared me for this today. I will never be apologetic. I will never turn my back on it. Who I am is special. He prepared me to carry His word forward. And without that alcoholism, I wouldn't be capable of doing what I do today. So I'm grateful and blessed to be an alcoholic. Thank you. Questions, small group?
Yeah,
I don't have any questions. No. Well, I have lots of questions.
Yeah. But
anybody have questions for Greg?
Where's the place at?
It's at 2021 Hobson Road. It's the old Dr. Patel's office, the first building south of State Street.
Across the street from the project.
Yeah, right across the street from the project. Yeah, and one of the great things is those people are starting to come over now.
Yep.
They're curious. They show up. They ask questions.
When is that the party where you...
Fun and Recovery?
Yeah.
That's every Saturday at 7 o'clock.
Slam?
No, we stay away from the slams. I had enough of those. But we typically barbecue and... what did we do? Barbecue chicken last week and all kinds of stuff. So we provide everything. Just show up and have fun with us.
Like cornhole?
I'm definitely finding that
problem
too, finding a way to have fun without alcohol. I've been doing it forever. It'd be nice for an outlet.
It is. And as Marvin mentioned, we're an open house, so from the time we get up at 6 to the time we go to bed at 10, show up. People do all the time. There's always coffee on, unless somebody drank the last cup and didn't reset it. But and we're always sitting outside. You know, we run a very hectic schedule. But there's always people in and out because they're in different phases. So there's almost always somebody there to sit, that will sit and talk to you, to fellowship with you. And that is our strength, is that we do this together.
Then you guys help us more than we help you. Trust me, that's what it's about, you know. Sharing our experience, sharing and help with each other, you know. That's how I look at it.
Greg, how do you get into the Hobson House?
Oh, right now we're full. But we do have a day program. We only have 15 beds. I've got 15 residents and about 25 waiting right now for those beds to open up. And of course, since we're a one-year program, I'm hoping that it's a really long wait. But we knew that we needed to do something else. So we have a hybrid day program. And that runs from 6:30 in the morning till about 8 o'clock at night. Anthony's one of our hybrids. So he comes in every morning. He eats with us, does our chores, does our morning meditation and prayer, and then goes into a schedule, comes back in the afternoon, some type of therapy, and then does our afternoon activities with us. And this is a service we provide for free to anybody who wants recovery. Traditionally, to get into Hobson House, we have a 10-day screening process. So it starts with an interview. And what we're looking is not that you have a problem, but do you want to change? Have you taken enough of a beating to put the needle down? Then I can work with you. Because if you're not ready, there's nothing I can do. So during that 10-day process, we ascertain, is this person ready? And we have several sets of daily tasks that we ask them to complete. And at the end of that time, they sit before an admissions board, which is comprised of some therapists from different places, myself, and some of our residents that have graduated and some that are there. And if they can convince all of us that they're ready to change, they're in. And from there forward, we pick up the tab. They're in right then and there. If they can't, they're welcome to come back to the hybrid, come back to the meetings, and keep working at it.
Costs?
Hybrid program's free. The first 90 days, 3 months is free in the program. After that, I believe our cost is $140 a week, but that includes 3 meals a day, your bed, cable, the gym, all the activities that we go through. That's an easy crowd. Okay, I was going to say it's an easy crowd. They don't have any questions.
One more, and you kind of touched on it, but it's always good to hear, and even just directly addressing it. What makes you different than the other halfway houses in town? And not to criticize them, but to talk about your different focus. And
there are a lot of faith-based other houses, and there are secular houses in town. The secular houses are pretty much pay us your $120 to $140 bucks. Here's your bed. Do your chores. Leave us alone. That's their program. There are very good faith-based houses in town. But again, not necessarily do they have the additional programming. The faith-based houses, while being great programs, are closed programs. You know, they don't invite guests. They don't have the fellowshipping, the networking. They don't have the additional programming that we offer. And when I was designing this, I took approach that we have to do all of it. You know, Matt came to me and weighed 134 pounds or something like that and looked like he was going to die in my chair. He had to go to the gym. He had to have proper nutrition. We had to exercise his mind, body, and spirit. And I think that's what makes us different, is that we look at the person as a whole. I've spoken to several people, and we're a spiritual program, but we're with the goal that we lead them to faith and salvation. We save their lives and then their souls. And I had a talk with somebody, and they said, they don't need that. They just need to pray. My response was, have you ever been to a doctor? Well, yes. Why? Couldn't you just pray? No. Those doctors were put there to treat us. The addictions counselors are put there to treat us. They are guides on these journeys. They make us well in body and mind. And so I think it's that overall approach that we look at that has set us apart from the other houses. Yeah?
Just briefly, the three steps you speak of. There's the first 90 days. You graduate to the next level, the final level, before you matriculate. What are those steps?
Okay, our phase one is where our gentlemen come in. That's the first 90 days. They're not allowed to have cell phones, electronics, computers. They never leave our property unescorted. We take them everywhere. Doctor's appointments, the gym, court appointments, case manager meetings, drug drops. Everywhere they go, we take them. They never leave our site. They need that time to develop the spiritual tools to deal with the world. There are a lot of things that are going on. That'd be a really long conversation, but they're not ready to deal with it on their own. So we're their guide through that process. In the second 90 days, we allow them to go back to work. They get their cell phone back. But they still have a whole list of meetings and therapies and classes and gym time that they have to adhere to. Their only free time is when they're actually at work. The rest of it is still ours. As they progress through that and into phase three, which is our final phase, now they have a lot more freedom. You know, they get passes home for the weekend. They get to do with their time as they please. Now, if we've done our job right, a lot of that time is service work. A lot of that time involves the house. Our few graduates are at the house every day helping out and bring guys around, and they're first ones to volunteer to go out to PBH or jail to see people. To me, that's a success. And those are our three phases, with the goal that we create servants of God who are grounded in humility, service, and faith. So far, our guys are doing pretty good.
Say in my life, just for my insurance.
Yeah.
Greg, how did you come up with your program? Was it pretty much your own idea? Did you copy something?
I started with the Delancey Street model, like Catalpa, the 2-year model, active revenue streams, and the more cloistered facility. And over the 5 years between the time I came home from jail and the time we actively started building the facility, I looked at it and I talked to the guys that were at the houses, and I saw what worked at the meetings, and I saw the successes in the program. And I asked them constantly, how did you do this? Or the people that went back out and then came back to us, what happened? And so over that period of time, we continued to change and refine the program. And it's still an ongoing process. These guys teach me as much every day as I teach them. Every time I think I've closed a loophole in the rules, they find five more, and I have to rewrite them all over again. But so yes, I did start with the Delancey Street model. All right.
One comment I'll make. I was introduced to Greg because I go to reentry court, and I forget who it was, but there was a gentleman, should I go off the hall and talk to him? And it was the strangest thing because he had an entourage. I'm following him out. And so I went to talk to him, and they kind of backed off a little bit. But that's, and I know I want to get your, I'll make a statement, but I want to get your comment on this. One of the things, and I've been to other halfway houses in town, and it seems like that they're just cold and kind of everybody's out for their own, and there's always challenges between residents. And the thing that I see with the Hobson House is that, and I've mentioned it to Greg, and this isn't the right word, but you guys are like a gang as you go around.
We prefer family, but yes.
Community is probably the better. But any comments on that?
Well, yeah, everywhere we go. Again, I talked about that loneliness, that hopelessness, the feeling of never fitting in. So everywhere we go, I don't have a big enough vehicle now to get all of us at the same time, but we go. Somebody goes to court and they're sitting in front of their judge the first time, and that was Tyler in reentry. He was nervous. He was scared. We went with him. You're not alone. We're here for you. And so everything we do, everywhere we go, is as brothers. So that feeling of hopelessness and loneliness and isolation gradually disappears. And we know that we have people that love us, no matter the mistakes we make, the dumb things we do, the rules we break. We'll always be there for each other. Even the two gentlemen we've had that, after 90 days, decided that they could do it on their own. They were ready. Both relapsed within 3 or 4 weeks, so they only completed a quarter of the program. But our doors are always open to them. And even in their lucid, sober moments, this is where they show up, because they know we're their brothers. And when they're ready, we will be there waiting for them, if they make it.
Volunteers that take the running program?
Like actually in the house?
Yeah.
Me and Nicole.
Okay.
So we're a staff of one and a half. Nicole's my significant other. So she runs the construction companies, her business, and then whatever time's left over, which she's managed to find about 60 hours a week, she spends at Hobson House, and then I'm there 7 days a week. I actually have a room and I stay there overnight. So that's our staff. Now we have an amazing support system with people like Marvin and Roger and Tom Heil and Jack, all these people that we have gravitated to our house and within the recovery community, the people with 30, 40, 50, 60 years sober, that's where they come. And they work with our guys and they sponsor them and they take them to meetings. And for us as a house, that's one of the most fortunate things, because most houses don't get that. And so I may be a staff of one full time, but we have many hands helping. Never enough. I'm not saying we don't need more, so.
But like, I'll say something.
Yeah,
absolutely. But like what Greg said, we're like brothers around here. We look after each other. If you're going to start isolating in your room or something like that, we're going to call you on it. Mm-hmm. So we all care about each other in the house, I made some terrific friendships in that house. For a guy who didn't even know what love meant, I didn't even know what love meant. But I developed it by the Hobson House and how much Greg showed me love and brought me in. I just met him, but I still love him, though. But we're like a brother. We're about a whole bunch of brothers. It's a big family in there. We check each other, We have fun, too, though.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Anthony.
I want to say something too. I've been there a week, and I'll tell you what, most of the time it takes, people to get used to each other quite a while, and I came in, and it's a family. It's a family, it's a unit, and everybody gets along, and everybody looks out for each other, and the people that have graduated, how many other houses you see, where the people just keep coming back every day, every morning, they're there, and they're willing to take people around and help out and take people when they need. And you don't see that. It's just, I've seen a lot of other halfway houses, and there's not a single one that sound like that. And just like he was saying, we help each other so much. The talks and conversations I've had have been unbelievable in that house, and it's amazing. And that's how they succeed there. They succeed.
I'll use an example. We have a family here that we have their son, and they brought him to us. And due to all the different things that he's going through, his inclination is lay down on the couch or go crawl in the conference room and sleep. And he does want to isolate. Now, he's clean. He's, you know, a month clean. And we have a long way to go. But these guys never leave him alone. To the point where he ran away on Sunday. Because they wouldn't leave him alone. And it's never vicious. And it's never nasty. And it's never name-calling. It's, hey, get up. Let's go cook. Hey, let's go play catch. Hey, it's time to go to a meeting. You got to stay awake. Let's do this.
It's motivation.
And he came back. And today he's better-ish. And tomorrow he'll be even better. And we won't ever leave him alone. Ever. We will always be there for them. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, the one thing that I think is really neat, exactly what some of the guys here at Center were there, is, you know, I think you can take 15 people in a family, 15 people in any circumstance, and I don't know that you would have 15 people get along as well as you guys do there. So there's going to be something special there, and I think it's going to be like I said, God is blessing it, blessing the fine line between, they know you're not going to take any punches, but you'll die, so you'll do both. And so it creates like the brotherhood. I mean, the military is the best example of conflict, but, you know, to get, you know, it's almost like, you know, it's awesome. You can get, take guys that don't know each other, and they put them together, and there's brotherhood there, you know, like that. So I think that's really.
And for us, you know, those of you that are in recovery and have worked a program will understand what I'm saying. There's a third step that we work, and it says we turn our will and our life over the care of God. Meaning we stop being the director. We try to the best of our ability every day to follow Him. And then at the very end, it says that once we've had this big spiritual awakening, we will practice His principles in everything we do and reach out to the alcoholic who still suffers. If those are your two mandates, really similar to love your brother as I have loved you, there's not a lot of room for conflict. Maybe a little bit of friction. But when we're all on that same page.
I mean, there's 15 guys and two showers, you know. Like, it's like, we make it work, though, man. We do. You know, we all jog together in the morning, do chores, you know. I mean, we just it's communication with each other. You know, stuff that we didn't know how to do before. We didn't know how to talk to people. I sure didn't, you know. I didn't talk to nobody. Didn't want to talk to nobody.
Every single day, one person cooks, you know, and some people do not know how to cook.
That is true.
You know, leaving the bowl, well, each other's problems, and once you get around somebody for so long, you catch on if they're in a bad mood, something's bothering them, just like your own brother, your mother, your father, you understand.
I see some people don't even gel like we do, man. You know, some families are distant, you know.
It's because we all have the same anchor. Well, that's it. All right.
Thank you very much, Greg.